From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. Another busy day in Washington. President Trump made a speech at the White House where he declared a U.S. withdrawal in Syria a success and announced that all sanctions against Turkey would be dropped. Many outside the administration say they do not see these moves as victory for the U.S. because it leaves the region to Turkish and Russian influence. And we're hearing more details today about an alleged quid pro quo between the Trump administration and Ukraine, including a readout of the testimony of top diplomat William Taylor. His statements sent shockwaves through Congress. Democrats have called them explosive, but Republicans say the entire inquiry is a breach of protocol. NPR political reporter Tim Mak joins us to break this all down. Hey, Tim.
Hey there.
So let's first talk about the highlights from William Taylor's statements to Congress, which NPR has obtained. Taylor, who is a career diplomat, a Vietnam War veteran, and apparently known as a comprehensive note taker, really laid out this roadmap detailing when he heard about the administration putting a hold on military aid to Ukraine. Can you walk us through that?
You're right that he's a comprehensive note taker. You know, his testimony has quotations, dates, conversations in a way that seems deliberate and contemporaneous. So Taylor told lawmakers on Capitol Hill on Tuesday that President Trump had orchestrated a parallel foreign policy for Ukraine that made U.S. aid to the country contingent on investigations that could help him politically. Now, you have heard the White House and Republican supporters of the president say that there was no quid pro quo. But this testimony provided to the investigating House committees suggests that there was, that the president and his political allies did link engagement with Ukraine and military assistance for Ukraine and appropriated by Congress to these politically related investigations that the Trump administration apparently wanted Ukraine to start. Remember also that this military assistance was authorized by Congress and was intended to help Ukraine combat threats from Russia.
Okay, so Taylor also described highly irregular back channels to Ukraine that circumvented usual diplomacy. And Taylor centers Rudy Giuliani at the heart of this. Can you tell us more about that?
So Taylor's prepared testimony kind of focuses on this timeline as he learns more and more about this irregular, informal channel of foreign policy that diverged from U.S. goals, okay? And it continues into how he found out that the president's personal attorney, Rudy Giuliani, had been either behind it or deeply involved in it. And Taylor pointed the finger at Giuliani and said it became increasingly clear to him over this past summer that American military assistance to Ukraine in a promised meeting between Trump and the new Ukrainian president, these things were contingent on the Ukrainian government cooperating with these investigations that Trump and Giuliani wanted started.
Okay, and I also think it's the first time we've heard this specifically. Taylor used direct language when describing the severe consequences of holding up this aid. He said Ukrainians would actually die at the hands of Russia. How did Taylor see his role in Ukraine, and how did he navigate the White House?
You know, it's interesting. Just for context, right, that Taylor has a long history with Ukraine. He served as ambassador to Ukraine during the Bush administration for approximately 3 years, and he also worked with the Ukrainian NGO during the Obama years to promote good governance and reform. So all of this is to say that Taylor is intimately familiar with the country and has made efforts to improve its future. And essentially, he has no illusions about the violent nature of the conflict between Ukraine and Russia. And he reminded the committees that even as this aid was being held up, there was a war going on in eastern Ukraine, that Russia had annexed Crimea in 2014, and there continues to be fighting in these eastern areas of the country, and that the invasion of Ukraine by Russia has challenged Ukrainian independence.
Okay, so looking to today, the Pentagon official who's testifying in the House today, her name is Laura Cooper. What do we know about her, and what do you think she'll be sharing with Congress?
So she's the Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense, and she oversees the Pentagon's efforts with regards to Ukraine, among other issues. And she's still testifying right now, so we don't know exactly what she is saying to them. This testimony is happening behind closed doors. But we do know what lawmakers will want to know about. They'll want to know about the Trump administration's decision to withhold military aid to Ukraine. Remember, of course, that this aid had been appropriated by Congress,
That's right.
The Pentagon had recommended that it be distributed to to the Ukrainians. So we'll have more in coming hours on what she's said to the committees.
Yeah, with 30 seconds, we of course, there are several more people to talk with, but what's next?
Well, the impeachment inquiry will pause Thursday and Friday as Congress marks the death of Congressman Elijah Cummings. But there are a number of officials still slated to be interviewed, staffers at the National Security Council, State Department officials, aides at the Office of Management and Budget, who are apparently behind the hold in military aid. All of these things will be moving forward in the next week and a half, and onward.
That's NPR's political reporter Tim Mak. Thanks, Tim.
Thanks a lot.
The president of the European Council says the European Union should grant the United Kingdom a Brexit delay. In a tweet, Donald Tusk said a delay would avoid the chaos of a no-deal departure from the EU next Thursday, Halloween, October 31st. That tweet came after British lawmakers rejected Prime Minister Boris Johnson's bid to fast-track his deal with the EU right after approving the actual deal. Here's opposition leader Jeremy Corbyn of the Labour Party speaking in the House of Commons today.
Does the Prime Minister accept that Parliament should have the necessary time to improve on this worse than terrible treaty?
Joining us now is NPR's Frank Langfitt in London. Frank, where are we now with Brexit scheduled to happen in just 8 days?
Well, what we're doing is we're really waiting to see what the EU says. I think that there will be some extension. The question is how long. One possibility is what they call a flex extension, basically says get your work done, get the Brexit across through the Houses of Parliament, and then you can leave. Or they may say up until January 31st. Boris Johnson, of course, would like it as soon as possible. He actually did get this bill the draft deal through on a second reading last night. So that was a huge victory for him. He feels like he has momentum. He'd love to push it through.
And he's been saying all along that he wants to leave on October the 31st. I haven't heard him say, well, actually, now it'll be after that yet, right? Has he backed off?
Jeremy, it is almost beyond comprehension that it would not be after October 31st.
Right.
I mean, to keep this in mind, yesterday, the Prime Minister said to the House of Commons, I'm going to give you 3 days to go through this. It's 115 pages of legislation. It is one of the most consequential pieces of legislation that this country has faced, tried to work through in many decades. And the House of Commons balked and said, no, we need more time. Just as you heard Jeremy Corbyn saying there, they want to look at this very, very closely. It's very tricky. There are things that people have already found, opposition legislators have already found that they don't like in the legislation that they think could come back to haunt them. So they want more time to go through it.
Now, in terms of the EU, we heard Tusk say there that he thinks they should be granted an extension. But there are some messages coming from the French president, Emmanuel Macron. He doesn't want to grant the UK another delay.
Well, I mean, it would be an understatement to say that the European leaders are exhausted with all of this. And they never expected that the British political system would have this much trouble dealing with this issue, and it would go on for years. So I think Emmanuel Macron would like to see this end. That said, Brussels is very pragmatic and has been very shrewd throughout all of these negotiations. They do not want a crash out that could cause – no doubt would cause economic damage to both the European Union and the United Kingdom. But also they don't want to be blamed for anything. They don't want people like Boris Johnson to be able to say if things go badly, oh, it's all the fault of Brussels. So I think it is most likely we'll see some kind of extension soon.
Is a crash out even still possible at all at this point?
It's Brexit, so this has
so
been
never
completely
know.
Unpredictable. I will caveat it simply by say I think that would be absolutely stunning. I don't think anybody sees that happening anytime soon, no.
Okay, now let's just talk about the politics of this for a minute, because the other thing that's being talked about is an early general election after what happened in Parliament yesterday. How would that help the situation, and why does Boris Johnson seem to favor a general election as soon as possible?
Well, his administration is divided over this, and it depends to some degree what they hear back from the EU. One way Boris Johnson could look at this is I think he is concerned that the more that opposition lawmakers begin to look at this deal that he's put together in the legislation, they'll pick away at it. They may amend it so much that it creates real problems for him. And so one thing he might want to do is he had a pretty good margin last night, Jeremy. He does deserve credit for a very significant victory. That said, he might think go for an early election, get a much bigger majority. I can fend off all those amendments. I can get the deal that I want. And also run on, I'm going to deliver Brexit. That would be his campaign message. That's one thought. He might want to wait until later if it's a, you know, if it looks like it might be a longer extension. It all depends.
Just a few seconds here, but I have to ask you about the other news today,
sure.
Frank. 39 people found dead in a truck east of London. What do we know?
Well, what we know is that this truck came in overnight from a port in Belgium, and it was parked at an industrial park. They've arrested the driver of the tractor trailer, 25-year-old man from Northern Ireland. We don't know who these people are or where they're from individually, but they certainly seem to be migrants, mm-hmm. and it seems like they may have suffocated in the back of this vehicle. And it's just – it's completely awful, Terry.
Yeah, terrible story. NPR's Frank Langfitt joining us from London. Frank, thank you.
You're very welcome.
This message comes from NPR sponsor MindBody. MindBody connects millions to the widest variety of local fitness classes, and they offer the same experience when it comes to massage and acupuncture, spas and salons. Find, book, and pay all in one place. Owners can join the network at mindbodyonline.com/NPR. MindBody, your access to the largest consumer wellness network and marketplace.
Fallout continues over the actions of a popular gaming company that suspended a player for voicing concerns over censorship in China. Activision Blizzard, one of the biggest gaming companies in the U.S., stripped, then partially restored tournament winner Ung Wai Chung, known as Blitzchung, of a tournament title and prize money this month after he called for the liberation of Hong Kong. A bipartisan group in Congress, as well as employees of Blizzard, have denounced the company and calls for the player's full reinstatement. We're joined now by Brian Kibler, a popular player and commentator for Blizzard's game Hearthstone, the same one Blitzchung played. He's been very vocal about all of this. Brian, welcome.
Good to be here.
So you were actually under contract to cover a live tournament at the popular gaming convention BlizzCon, which is actually coming up next Saturday. But you resigned because of how Blizzard reacted to Blitzchung's statements. Tell us why that was important for you to take that step.
Well, yes, I was slated to be one of the commentators for the finals of the Grandmasters League, which is the event where Blitzchung made his statement. And when I saw the response, I just felt like it was completely out of line with what he had done. Even if there was an understandable desire to sort of keep their broadcast under control and not have people using it as a platform for political statements, you know, they responded in such an extreme way that I didn't want to be associated sort of as a representative of that decision.
Initially, Blitzchung had been suspended for a year, and they pushed it back to 6 months. And there were some other things that they also pushed back on.
Correct. So originally, as you said, he was slated to be banned for a year and also removed from the Grandmasters League entirely. And that's, you know, effectively the pro league for Hearthstone. And after all the outcry, they eventually did make the statement that, you know, they had overreacted. Their punishment was too extreme. And they reduced all of that to suspending him for 6 months from tournaments, which actually conveniently lines up with when the next season for the Grandmasters begins, so we will still be able to compete in that next year.
Okay. I would love for you to explain your role. You do live stream and provide commentary for popular video games. Explain this role a little bit and the importance of it. I mean, you stepping out, there's a lot of money involved in this.
Yeah, so I am a video game broadcaster professionally. I actually broadcast myself playing games, typically Hearthstone. And then I also do essentially the equivalent of sports broadcasting for their major events. It's my job. And, I was slated to cast the event, and deciding not to do it does cost me my paycheck.
Okay. But there's also questions around the company's business interests in China. The Chinese market only makes up about 12% of Blizzard's revenue, but there's a lot of ground to cover there. Your thoughts about this and maybe why that harder action was taken and why you're upset about all this?
Well, I think that the cynical reason was that, you know, there was some sort of degree of their business interest in China that was motivating this. Perhaps some of their Chinese business partners had said, hey, you know, this is a pretty big deal here. You need to come down pretty hard on that. They said in their statement that the punishment was not related Two, there have been interest in China, which I'd like to believe. But you know, if that's the case, then some other element sort of kind of must be missing from the story that everyone has heard about this, because it seems like the degree of overreaction was huge. If this was someone who had made a statement about politics in the U.S., would there have been that same action? Right.
China also has the largest mobile games market in the world. That can't really be ignored. There's lots of investment going into China and really tapping into that market, I would assume.
It's huge. And I mean, frankly, one of the things that people were concerned about with Blizzard's initial response was that it was a reaction to this. And specifically, Activision Blizzard is sort of the full company. And Activision is releasing their new Call of Duty game and trying to get it approved for release in China kind of as we speak. So there was some speculation of, was this motivated by the desire to have access to that market? Which, again, the statement that was put out by the president of Blizzard denied. But it is pretty clear that there must have been something else going on there in my view.
What would it take for Blizzard to do to convince you to come back? They've walked back some of what they've done for Blitzchung, but what about you in coming back to Blizzard?
Well, I think that the reversal of course with, frankly, the statement that, hey, we screwed up is enough for me to at least view working with them in the future as a possibility. I still intend to sit out the broadcast at BlizzCon for the Grandmasters Finals, simply because I think that their initial response was so out of line. So I feel like there, has to be some sort of real consequences to getting it that bad the first time.
Brian Kibler, video game streamer and pro player, thank you so much for joining us, Brian.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Well, it is the time of year when we start seeing a lot of sweet potatoes in stores. But what if you're just not a fan of sweet potato pie or that Thanksgiving sweet potato dish with the marshmallows? Gross. Let's bring in here now resident chef Kathy Guntz, who has some new takes on sweet potatoes. And Kathy, I have to say, I'm one of those people. I don't like sweet potatoes. I love everything, but I don't love sweet potatoes.
I'm really surprised.
They're too sweet.
Too sweet. So we're going to change your mind. I purposefully did not focus on desserts here.
Okay.
Because I want to show you the possibility of taking something sweet and how adaptive it is.
Okay.
So where do you want to start?
Let's start with this mac and cheese, because you can't go wrong with a mac and cheese.
Well, I had two thoughts with you. I was told Jeremy doesn't love sweet potatoes. And I'm like, okay, I can get them if I make a taco and if I make mac and cheese. This is a ricotta and sweet potato mac and cheese.
Okay.
I used small penne. You could use your favorite shape. And it's a very creamy, cheesy sauce with fresh ricotta in it. And then I baked a sweet potato ahead of time, cubed it, and just sprinkled it throughout the pasta and then on top of it. It gives a counterpoint to the richness of the mac and cheese.
The thing is, it's got the texture of a carrot, the sweet potato does.
Is that bad?
I think. No, I just think it's a sweet carrot, basically, to me.
Okay. All right. Let us keep going because you're not there yet.
Okay, I'm not there yet. But is this easy to make?
Very easy to make. You boil some pasta. You make a quick cheese sauce. You melt some butter, add some flour, throw some milk in, a little bit of grated parm and the ricotta, and you're done.
Okay.
And then you get the sweet potato. You make the whole thing ahead of time, pop it in the oven a half an hour before you want to eat it. I think you could serve that to a 2-year-old or a 90-year-old and anybody in between.
Okay. What about this taco? Maybe this will convince me.
Oh, man, you are rough. Okay, here we go. I know that you love tacos, and I know that you love spice. So I took a spicy sausage, took it out of the casing, and sautéed it. I steamed the sweet potato and then threw it in a skillet with the sausage, put it on a corn tortilla with feta, and then I fried, you can use ancho or chipotle peppers, I fried the chilies, they're dried chilies, in a little bit of oil to crisp them up. So you're going to get some spice.
Okay, I'm going to take a bite right now.
Take a bite. Good luck.
Mm.
Say it again.
Mm.
All right, because here the sweet potatoes, that sweetness is playing off the heat.
They're a supporting role in this taco.
No, you're wrong.
You think they're the main event?
They are the main event, because even though you're tasting the sausage and the chili peppers, it's really the sweet potato that's giving you the total flavor profile.
It is delicious. I will say, in this case, I do love this taco.
We're getting there.
There's one more thing you've got here with sweet potatoes, and that is some fries.
Yeah, fries in air quotes. So these are baked. You have a white sweet potato and then a more traditional orange sweet potato. I oven baked them into, quote, fries, and I made a miso mayonnaise. Mm. Miso's got a strong umami flavor, and it's mixed with scallions and regular old mayo, and you dip them in. And again, very kid-friendly, but also quite adult-friendly.
These are delicious.
Okay, you now, come from 0 to 90.
But here's what I'm wondering.
Yes.
Are these healthier for you than a regular old French fry?
I'm so glad you asked
because
that
would make me do it.
Okay, well, a regular old French fry is deep fried, and these are not. You can crisp them up under the broiler so that they're soft and tender on the inside and have a bit of crunch. But let me just tell you, if you take a white potato, it's got 130 calories. A sweet potato's got 90. Hmm. A white potato has 29 grams of carbs, sweet potato 24. Sweet potato has more fiber, it has a little bit less protein, and it's actually got a little bit more sugar, natural sugars. All in all, sweet potatoes, particularly if you eat the skin, are way healthier for you. They're considered an antioxidant and an anti-inflammatory food. You get a ton of fiber. And then there's all this vitamin A and C, and it's really low in calories.
So I know that there are a lot of people who disagree with me and love sweet potatoes, including somebody on our staff who I walked by their desk and said, "Is that a yam?" And she said, "No, it's a sweet potato." So what is the difference between a yam and a sweet potato?
So for a long time in this country, we use those terms interchangeably. Mm-hmm. But the fact is they're very different vegetables. A sweet potato is sweet. It's actually in the morning glory family. You know those flowers that climb up the side of buildings? It's got tapered ends and a thin, smooth skin. A yam is a different plant. It's a starchy root vegetable. It's cylindrical, and it's got a very rough, dark skin. And it's much lower in beta carotene, which the sweet potato is loaded with. Yams are from Africa and the Caribbean and Southeast Asia. They're found in ethnic markets, and they're very starchy and dry. And a sweet potato is sweet and moist if it's cooked well.
Okay, well, we will have the recipes for some of these sweet potato dishes, including one or two that actually got me to maybe rethink my thoughts on the sweet potato at hereandnow.org. Here and Now resident chef Kathy Guntz, thanks as always.
Thanks, Jeremy. Thanks for being open.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
Some potentially hopeful news for people suffering from Alzheimer's. A biotech company, Biogen, is reviving plans to seek federal approval for a drug to treat early Alzheimer's disease. This news comes as a surprise because it directly contradicts a decision from the company back in March to end studies after partial results showed it wasn't likely to be successful. Sharon Begley is a senior science writer for our partners at STAT, the Health and Medicine publication. And Sharon, tell us a little bit more about this reversal. What changed?
What happened over the ensuing 6 months or so was that the company had additional data, more information on more patients and how they were doing, and it reanalyzed the data that it did have. And lo and behold, it has now concluded that, in fact, the drug can slow the rate of cognitive decline in, as you said, this particular group of patients, those with very mild Alzheimer's disease or even pre-Alzheimer's disease.
We actually have sound from Dr. Al Sandrock, who serves as the medical officer at Biogen. He spoke about these findings and how those changes to the study made a big difference. He spoke with WBUR. Here he is.
Sustained dosing with high-dose aducanumab led to enough amyloid removal so that we could get the clinical effects on reducing clinical decline.
And amyloid is actually a protein that clumps up in the brain. Can you explain a little bit more about what he means here and how that drug helps with that?
Right. So the idea that amyloid is the cause of Alzheimer's has been dogma in the field for really 30 years. And so that's why Biogen produced this molecule that destroys the amyloid in the brain. And as Dr. Sandrock said, especially at the highest doses, which not all patients were on for the entire trial, that was an indication that the drug was not only doing what it was supposed to, but then, again, when they measured the cognitive capacity of the people in the trial, it looked like the decline in amyloid was also connected to a slower rate of cognitive loss in these patients, which was exactly the signal that they were looking for.
Why has it been so hard to find an effective drug up until now?
It's a really, really hard disease. So there are a lot of explanations that people have offered. One is that they enrolled patients whose Alzheimer's was moderate or even severe. Mm. And even if you remove amyloid from the brain, they have lost so many neurons that they unfortunately cannot be helped. Another bunch of studies enrolled patients who, it turns out, this was not known at the time, they might not even have had Alzheimer's disease, at least as defined by the presence of amyloid in the brain. So they were given these drugs that removed amyloid, but they didn't have amyloid, so obviously it wasn't going to have an effect. Biogen has produced a much more effective molecule. It carefully enrolled patients, and now it seems to have gotten the success that it announced on Tuesday.
Got it. So Biogen says they plan to submit their license application to the Food and Drug Administration by early next year. But in the meantime, what's next as they wait for this approval?
Well, outside researchers have a lot of questions. Biogen was actually running two clinical trials simultaneously. One of them failed, and that's very curious because the patients in the failed trial were basically identical to those in the trial where there was a benefit. So that's really a curiosity that you can be sure the FDA will be looking hard at.
That's Sharon Begley. She is senior science writer for our partners at STAT, the Health and Medicine publication. Sharon, thank you.
Thank you.
President Trump said today that he is lifting sanctions on Turkey and that Turkish combat operations against Kurds had ceased. Yesterday, Turkey and Russia announced that they would patrol the area of Syria previously run by the U.S. and the Kurds. This comes 2 weeks after Turkey's invasion of part of Syria, which was blessed by President Trump. French philosopher Bernard-Henri Lévy has been a vocal advocate for the Kurds and joins us now from New York. Welcome back to Here and Now.
Thank you.
So you've spent a lot of time with the Kurds in Syria and Iraqi Kurdistan. You embedded yourself with the Kurdish military years ago. What was your reaction when you heard that the U.S. troops were pulling out of Syria?
I was desperate for the Kurds, and I was so, so sad for America. Because the Kurds, as you said, I know them well. I was with them on the front line for month and month, following their battles against ISIS. And they are girls and boys fighting with such bravery for America, for the West, for civilization, in favor of democracy. And the way they were dropped flat, the way they have been abandoned after having been used, is so opposite to the spirit of America that, honestly, it's heartbreaking. I imagine someone who believes, as I do, in the American creed. How can this be conceived and how can this be understood? So this was my reaction. First of all, I thought about my mates, the Kurds, which I left on the battlefield, and then I thought about this dear country to my heart, which is America, and I was very, very sad.
Well, and tell me more about the part involving the American spirit that you just talked about there. And you wrote about a betrayal of American values. You say the Kurds represent the secular Islam that America should want to promote.
Number one, the Kurds were brother in arms. And there is a law in the American tradition, which is that you don't abandon someone with whom you shared blood. Number two, you are right. the Kurds embody more than anyone else this democratic, secular, enlightened Islam which we are all looking for. An Islam who put on a foot of equality women and men, for example. I don't know any other place where it is true to such a scale. In the battalions in which I was embedded, not in Syria, but in Iraq, in some of these battalions, the best fighters were women. They were absolutely the equals of the men. So it is a great people. And how can we behave like this with a people who matches so well with what we have in the depth of our heart? It's unthinkable for me.
But it is where we are at this point. And I want to get your reaction to this deal now between Russia and Turkey to patrol this safe zone together. What do you think of it, and what does it mean for the Kurds?
What it means for the Kurds is pure disaster. They have the now two enemies against them, but disaster for America. The foreign policy of America has managed to deliver on a silver dish the Kurds and the Middle East to the three biggest enemies of America: Putin, the Iranians, and now the Turks. So countries who do not share your values and our values, because Erdogan, of course, is in NATO, but he should not be after that. If he stays in NATO, NATO is dead, NATO. But Erdogan embodies values which are not American values. Putin is the adversary of America, clearly. And Iran is supposed to be the adversary also. And we have now these three countries, hand in hand, managing the area, pretending to be peacemakers, and holding the whole area. The Trump policy is on one side to pretend that Iran deserves sanctions and so on, and on the other side, on the battlefield and on the ground, to tell to Iran and to his ally, Bashar al-Assad and Putin, help yourself. This is the real situation.
I want to focus on something you just said there, which is you believe that after what Turkey has just done, that NATO is dead. Do you think that that's true? Should Turkey be kicked out of NATO?
In emergency, how can we have? Normally, the text of NATO should oblige us to fight with Turkey against the Kurds. Thanks God we don't do that. This is what NATO recommends. We are walking on the head. It is the reverse world. So NATO with Turkey inside has no sense. I must add that Erdogan now is making blackmail on America and on Europe on all grounds, blackmail on refugees, blackmail on jihadists.
Because
on
he's
Islamists.
Saying that he will send back some of the refugees, many of the refugees, millions of them that he has taken
millions
to Turkey,
them.
To Europe. Right.
Number one. Number two, he has put the hand on some thousands of terrorists who were detained by the Kurds. Now they are detained by him. He threatens also to send them back to Europe or to America. Second blackmail. And third blackmail, don't forget that he has a basis on his ground. NATO has a basis. EasyLink, which is very important, where the NATO have 50 nuclear heads, which are there. This is inconceivable. America and NATO cannot live in the hands of this Muslim brother, enemy of our friends, such a power of destruction. So Erdogan does whatever he wants, but he cannot stay in NATO. He must be at least suspended. This is what I will plead on Saturday night at the New York Times Center. First retaliation to do is to tell him, out of NATO. And then number two, hands off the Kurds. And if we had told Erdogan in due time, if you go on the Kurds, you will be expelled of NATO, maybe he would have thought twice.
Bernard-Henri Lévy, let me ask you this. We've been talking here about what you say the Trump policy is what failed here. What about the European nations? Should they step in a greater way to assist this situation and help the Kurds?
Of course, yes. Yes, yes, yes. A responsibility is on all of us, European included. When Trump announced that the 2,000 special forces of America will withdraw, I wrote a paper in France saying immediately that Europe should send soldiers to replace the American soldiers. It was easy for us. 2,000 soldiers is nothing. 27 or 28 with the Brits, countries of Europe, are able to send 2,000 soldiers in order to keep the peace and to prevent Erdogan and to prevent Bashar al-Assad now to crush the Kurds. And to say that it is impossible is a joke.
While we have you, I want to ask you about one more thing, and that is Brexit. The latest deadline is October 31st, although that may now be extended. First of all, why do you think Britain is having such a hard time deciding what to do? And secondly, do you think that France's president, Macron, could actually be the one to block an extension to Brexit?
Second question, I think he might, but I think he will not. First question, why is it such a mess? For a simple reason. This is what happens when you use a populist and demagogic way of leading democracy. When you ask to a people to reply by yes or no to such a complex question, the problems come after. And the people of Great Britain, the parliament, are dealing since 3 years and a half with the questions which have not been raised in due time before the referendum. The referendum was just a carnival of liars, a carnival of crooks. After they won the referendum, they went down to the shelters and they left the parliaments with all the pending and difficult questions, border, not border, Northern Ireland, South Ireland, war or not, and so on and so on. So what is happening is normal. It is the normal exercise of democracy in England, because it was not exerted in due time before.
That is Bernard-Henri Lévy, the French philosopher. Thank you so much. Always great to talk with you.
Thank you.
Teachers, students, and families from Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School don't want people to forget how their lives changed when a gunman killed 17 people on a February afternoon last year. Some of their stories are featured in a new exhibit. WLRN's Katie Swatulski has the story from Coral Springs, Florida.
Ian Whitland shows me photographs of the faces of students and former students, teachers.
You'll see some walls are grouped as students, some are grouped as teachers, some are a mix. And then as you get to the end, there's some of the families of the victims.
All of them have been affected by the shooting at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School over a year and a half ago. Whitland graduated from Stoneman Douglas in 2001, and his giant black and white photographs are gathered in a new exhibit at the Coral Springs Museum of Art called Anguish in the Aftermath, Examining a Mass Shooting. The 51 photos are candid. Whether it's looking away or wiping a tear, the faces aren't just sitting posed and pretty. Whitland says there's a reason for that.
Going back to Columbine, what I've seen in history books are portraits of people, beautifully done, beautifully lit, don't get me wrong, but they're more along the lines of a headshot, a posed photo. I never really connected with that. I don't know how other people feel. But when you think of history and you really want to connect with something, it's something that's raw and visceral.
Emotion is what he wanted. No pro or anti-Second Amendment statements, even though he knows some people will experience it that way.
The project is completely apolitical. So what they have to say and what they've been through, I want people to be able to see and get back to the matter at hand, how this affects people in our society.
Whitland asked everyone who sat to talk to him the same two questions.
Please tell me your personal experience on February 14th, 2018, and then what would you like to see come from this?
He recorded their answers, and as you move through the exhibit, you can hear each person tell you in their own words. Like Diana Hineski, the media specialist at the Stoneman Douglas Library. On the day of the shooting, Hineski hid 55 students in an equipment room in the back of the library. This is her voice in the exhibit.
We were all on the floor, hiding behind carts and things. And because of the radio, I started hearing that they were looking for a shooter.
Whining in the background is the school's therapy dog, River, who lives with Hineski now. when she had her portrait taken by Whitlin, River came along. And when Hineski came back to the museum to see the exhibit for the first time, River came too.
All right, so we're going to mine.
Yep. And I can walk you through everything after, or you can walk through it now. Okay. So it's up to you, whatever you feel at ease with.
Okay.
It can be a bit overwhelming at times.
Oh, what happened to my face? And then I realized that's a breath in there. And I'm like holding on to that air, and you could see it right there on my cheek. And it's amazing that you captured that.
You had taken in a breath, and you weren't letting it out.
Hineski says, now breathing is part of her healing.
This is basically how I've gotten through everything. We do these meditations. It's like breathe in love, breathe out peace. But I feel very hopeful because, you know, I feel like I look different now than then. I want more joy.
Portrait to portrait, the healing process looks different for everyone. You see shock, anger, sadness, and signs of strength. There's one image of a young man almost covering his face with his hand. His eyes are closed, and he's wiping away a tear. Spencer Blum was a junior when the shooting happened. In the exhibit, you hear him recount some of the details from that day. The radio on his drive home from the school.
And as we're in the car with my stepdad and my sister and my sister's friends, we hear Wolf Blitzer saying, there was a shooting at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida. We're letting you know more news. And then I remember as the day kept going on, the number of people who were dead just continued to rise.
After he safely evacuated campus, Blum learned one of his close friends, Nicholas Dworet, was among those killed. Blum says his experience telling Whitlin his story was a cathartic one. He talked to me on the phone from his new college dorm room in Tampa after Whitlin emailed him his portrait.
It conveyed in that one photograph so much power and emotion and feeling. That's really what's so great about this project is it, one, allowed people to heal, but it's also allowing people who might want to understand a bit more about what we experienced to come in and, you know, hear how we felt and then kind of get a better understanding of how difficult it is to really heal.
The exhibit's photographer, Ian Whitlin, wants to keep taking photos of Stoneman Douglas survivors.
You know, there's people who aren't ready to speak yet. There's people that 2 years from now might be ready to speak, and I'm happy to talk to them then.
After Coral Springs, the exhibit will travel around South Florida. Whitlin also hopes it can reach other communities recovering from mass shootings of their own, like El Paso, Texas, and Dayton, Ohio. For Here and Now, I'm Katie Switalski.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.